Dr. Cuthright, speaking to Hospodářské noviny several weeks before Russia's attack, you said that there was a 70% chance that Russia will go ahead with the invasion. This was at a time when many people were sceptical that Vladimir Putin would go so far, despite the troop build-up. What led you to believe Vladimir Putin was going to order the invasion to go ahead?
Back then, I was not sure that Vladimir Putin already ordered the invasion to happen. But from my perspective, I was thinking like this. He has some demands with Ukraine, like the neutralization, ideally the end of the NATO accession process, and also he wanted the federalization of Ukraine under very specific terms, but that's not important. And simply, it was very easy to see that he was not able to get these demands either from West or from Zelensky. Okay. So from this perspective, basically the war was the last option he had if he wanted so badly to achieve his goals.
Precisely, achieve his goals. And I'm guessing that also in how you're thinking about it, you took very seriously Putin's historical essay last year and generally what has been written about him, that he really does have this vision of bringing back together the countries of the former Soviet Union.
It is possible that this plays some role. On the other hand, I think that even without this essay and even without this worldview, the Russian demands, as they were clearly a non-starter for negotiations. So even if the aim was not to restore some kind of a Soviet Union, it was relatively clear that the war is the only one option to achieve even more limited goals, like I said just before.
I understand. And, you know, if we move forward in time to now, the invasion has been going on so far for nearly a week. Today is day six. How do you think it is developing for the Russians? Many people say that the Russians underestimated Ukraine.
This is kind of interesting because prior to war, my estimates were the Ukrainians should be able to mount an effective and an integrated defense against Russians for at least 2 to 3 weeks. That was my preliminary assessment. And by trying to model the situation with the help of, for example, Biddle's model about forced employment, that's not so much important, but I was not able to get to lower numbers. So my initial expectation was 2 to 3 weeks for an effective, not a resistance, but defense in a classical conventional military sense. It was the minimum. So from this perspective, I'm not so much surprised by now. What is, however, indeed surprising is that Russians indeed probably thought that they could destroy the Ukrainians' will to fight back within few days. This seems to me almost ridiculous. This seems to me to be a total misunderstanding of the situation. It seems to me that they were the first victim of the hybrid war in the sense that they actually started to believe their own lies. That they believed that the Ukrainians will be welcoming them and that the Ukrainians will not be willing to fight back at least for some time. This was entirely wrong. So it is very likely that the Russians underestimated Ukrainians and now they are entrapped in a relatively costly war against relatively determined opponent and they are fighting with units or their own units, I mean the Russian units, are not willing to fight very much.
I don't know if you saw earlier on Tuesday, US Senator Chris Murphy tweeted some sort of information that he found out at a classified talk in the US Senate that was given to them. And it seems that also our leadership seems to believe that also President Putin underestimated the situation. We could go a lot into the sort of actual tactical situation on the ground. I mean, the battalion tactical groups seem to have been sent in underwhelming numbers compared to how much they were amassed. There are reports today that Russians are using unsecured comm channels. I mean, it really does seem very, very strange. There are also, you know, accusations of corruption in the army, etc. So why do you think? You think he just believed ultimately his own propaganda, Vladimir Putin? Or do you think this could be maybe a thing in authoritarian states where the command may issue an order, but actually,
there is no feedback from the lower-ranking officers? Yeah, I think this is precisely what might have happened. You know, the regime right now is almost a classical personalist regime. And it seems to me that the people around Vladimir Putin are more and more incompetent. Also, what is important to note, a few years ago, Russia created Rosgvardia, another military group which is outside of the normal chain of command. So they created some kind of a parallel structure. No wonder that we hear right now stories about Rosgvardia's companies trying to seize Kiev single-handedly, which seems so absurd, but it's very likely that they are not coordinated with the rest of the army, and even the rest of the army does not coordinate well with each other. But the problems with Rosgvardia will be most likely even more extreme. And in those personalist regimes, it's typical to create those parallel structures, both military structures and information structures. And it's not so surprising that the people in this environment, when nobody can be sure about his own status, and it's very much connected with the goodwill of the leader, in this case Vladimir Putin, that nobody is willing to provide honest feedback to plans, informations, intel, whatever, plus the coordination of these doubled systems or doubled components usually tend to be extremely weak.
You said in your assessment Ukraine could hold 2 to 3 weeks.
At least.
Ah, okay. So were you analysing just a Russian attack in the Donbass area or the actual attack that took place? Because very few people expected such a large scale.
Actually, my initial expectation was that Russia will try to topple the regime, to get at least the eastern third of the country, simply behind the Dnieper River, because otherwise it would make no sense. If the demands were to end the accession to NATO, to make the country more or less neutral, and to eliminate its ability to produce arms, not only to be armed by NATO countries, but also somehow to eliminate its ability to produce own weapons, the only one thing which would ensure such a goal would be some kind of a either occupation, which would be extremely expensive, or changing the regime. So from my perspective, it was always about at least the eastern third of the country.
Okay, so I guess from your perspective, actually what's happening is not so surprising, at least if we're not talking about the seemingly botched initial attack. Ukraine still has some time to hold out. People are optimistic. They think this might develop into Russia losing the war, but of course overwhelming force still stands with the Russian army, and people are still wondering how long Ukraine can hold out. But you are saying basically 2 to 3 weeks at least.
That would be my guess, and by now I think that it's more likely to talk about 4 to 6 weeks, maybe even a little bit more. It depends, because so far the Russians made some huge mistakes. The question is how quickly they can adapt. Russian army is not well known for ability to adapt, but we cannot rule it out. And it's also possible that Ukrainians will make some huge mistakes. And actually, let's be honest, the Ukrainians did a really great job around Kharkiv, the really big city, something like 1.5 million, very important, even a historically important city for the region in the eastern Ukraine. But they were not very much prepared in the south. You know, the Russians were able to break through the Perekop isthmus, which should be relatively difficult, yet they were able to break through. And within 6 hours, they were able to occupy a bridge in Nova Kakhlovka over Dnieper. So they were able to get to the other side of the Dnieper. 6 hours. Oh my God, that's a tragedy. I expected that the Ukrainians will be able to mount an effective resistance there for several days. And if you look to the south sector, you can see that Russians were able to go to Berdyansk, an important city in or close to Azov Sea. They are very close to Mariupol. And it seems that they will be able, if they will continue in the operation for the next few days, that they will be able to get to Dnipropetrovsk. And this would make the situation very complicated for the Ukrainian army fighting with the separatists. The Ukrainian army would have the choice either to move out as soon as possible or to risk and circumvent.
Indeed. I mean, the Russian advances seem to be going okay in the east and south, if we don't count large cities. Which brings me to my next question, the negotiations going on between the Ukrainians and the Russians in Belarus currently. Do you think the Russians might be sort of turning down on their demands now, or is it way too early for that? If you had to make a guess, what would you guess that the two sides are negotiating on?
It's just a guess, so yeah. Take it as just a speculation. But my hope, small reason for an optimism, is that Russians were quite surprised by the swift sanctions, which are relatively strong. It's really impossible to say that the sanctions are weak. Actually, they are quite strong and they are hitting Russian economy quite hard. And also what is important in this respect, it seems that Russian soldiers are not very happy to fight the war. That's also very important. And also it is important to see that Russian population is not very happy from the war. Actually, the Putin regime tried to conceal the war, which is kind of strange and really puzzling, because how can you conceal such a kind of a huge war? But yet they were trying. So it is possible that right now for Putin's regime, it might be relatively difficult to say, okay, now we need to deal with the situation. Let's move toward a planet war economy, which would be kind of extreme shift from the current pattern. It would not be just sanctions. It would be that you would be issuing some kind of a ration system and such a kind of really extreme economic steps, which could save the Russian economy for several months or years, but obviously it would hit the population very hard. So I hope a little bit that the Russians feel the pressure of the time and that they realize that they do not have plenty of time to accomplish all of their goals. So my hope is that they will be willing to change at least some of their initial proposals. But the question is whether it will be enough for Zelensky to accept.
Exactly. I guess there's that other Ukrainian factor now, isn't there, is that the Ukrainians basically demanding they won't give up any territory. So now it's, are the Ukrainians also going to be willing to do it? Or do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. It seems to me that as Russians had some kind of a war optimism before the war, it seems to me that it's possible that Zelensky is catching the same disease right now. And I do understand it. Obviously, we should stay realistic. Because when I hear, for example, that some people are demanding Russians should move out of Crimea, we are playing with fire in that sense. And also, it's fair to note, as we said, in the south, the situation looks terribly, and it might turn pretty, pretty bad there very soon. But true is that Zelensky has some cards in his hand right now, and if played smartly, I think that he can try to reach some kind of a agreement. Obviously, the question is if he is not too much optimistic by now.
Very serious Western sanctions, Vladimir Putin's putting of the nuclear forces on standby, you know, speaking of escalation, basically. Are you worried that this conflict could escalate a bit out of control, as some experts are warning, or do you think that's not going to happen?
I think that the probability of some kind of a nuclear strikes or full-out nuclear war is relatively small. On the other hand, I would not underestimate this possibility. You know, because Vladimir Putin said for several years in a row, if Ukraine will continue on its path to NATO membership, there will be harsh consequences. And it was pretty easy to understand that he is talking about a war. Now we have a war. I'm not saying that the NATO expansion or NATO accession is the only one cause here. But it was obviously one important part of this whole story. And so that's a reason why even now I would be careful about the nuclear weapons or their possible use. Because it's pretty clear from the words of Vladimir Putin that is saying, this is my red line. So it makes sense for NATO to be relatively cautious about this possibility.
Okay, and you know, we're talking about escalation. I guess, you know, in the grander picture, we should also look at the whole, basically, international system. Some people accused Vladimir Putin of trying to sort of destroy or at least fundamentally challenge the sort of liberal order that's been in place since 89 of international law. Do you agree with that? Do you think that this was a real sort of challenge that maybe Putin may have also negotiated with the Chinese, but the Chinese didn't end up supporting him as much? Or what do you think happened there?
Hard to know, but definitely it's clear that Putin does not like the current international order, if you want to call it order. I would say rather something like international balance of power. And probably he thought that he will be able to topple the current situation or the current order and to create something more favorable for Russia. And I think that what we see right now is that simply he was not strong enough. He was not capable enough to do that. And it seems to me that the whole situation is backfiring against him because, you know, he was talking about his dislike for NATO. And yes, to some extent, we can understand it. But by his very actions, he is promoting the idea of NATO membership in Finland, in Sweden. I guess pretty much all the countries in Central and Eastern Europe will start to increase their military expenditures. Because now they see the war is option for Russia, and we can't believe them. So actually, he's cutting the tree on which he's sitting right now. And that's really, really paradoxical situation. By trying to stop NATO, he's making NATO more and more powerful.
Indeed, and you were talking here, you know, about previously neutral European states, perhaps prospectively might join NATO. Also Germany increasing its military budget, doubling it, I believe. Do you think this is a time when we may have to really reevaluate how we've been thinking about international relations and Western strategy since 89, or do you think that's getting a bit too ahead of ourselves that we seem to be managing the situation?
Look, I have been a card-carrying realist for something like 12 years since I started my PhD studies. So I would say I personally do not have to re-evaluate anything because this is something which was to some extent predicted by realists. Definitely, I think that especially non-realists will have to think harder about the possibilities of war and about the old so-called old concepts of balance of power. And I think that even the society will have to think harder about those very ugly questions of war and peace. And the fact that in the international realm, sometimes it's not about, let's say, rhetorical positions and norms and ideas, but it's much more about tanks and your will to fight.
Maybe it's just good for listeners if we sort of explained what realism in international relations is compared to other theories. So what does it really mean to be a realist?
Okay, so realism is not about norms and ideas so much. Realists, they do not believe that states behaves according to some kind of a norms. States behave according to self-interest, and their primary self-interest is self-preservation. And there are two schools of thought in our realism or modern realism. One says the states try to achieve security. It means that they do not necessarily want to gain more power. That's because these authors, they think that extremely powerful states, that they attract balancing behavior from others because they are feared that they are too powerful, so it makes no sense for you to try to gain more power. But then they are offensive realists and they say, well, more or less the states try to gather more and more power, even though they know that it might lead to some hegemonic wars, that it might lead to balancing coalitions, but simply the pursuit of hegemony or potential hegemony is kind of rational in the situations when you think that you can change the situation on the ground quickly and with relatively small costs.
Do you think Vladimir Putin is a realist who miscalculated?
I'm not sure whether he is a realist, but he plays more along the realist lines than at least some European politicians. But this might be driven mostly by the fact that Vladimir Putin, what he has in his cards. Gas, yes, that's one option, but this is kind of double-edged sword because his economy is dependent on the gas. So even in the current situation, he is selling us his gas. What is the second option? Conventional army. And third option, or third card, nuclear weapons. So it's kind of obvious that Vladimir Putin is more reliant on brute force than some other leaders. By the way, I'm not saying that what he's doing is okay. I'm just trying to understand what is structurally behind this. So I'm not sure if he's a truly realist, because in his remarks, you can see plenty of, I would say, imperialist thinking, which is quite far away from realism, because realism is also about ability to understand that, for example, occupation of a foreign country or toppling a regime in a foreign country is extremely risky and potentially extremely costly business, which can antagonize other powers, which is something which happened. And my guess is that Vladimir Putin somehow believed that people of Ukraine will be more or less, at least in some regions, happy with Russians.
And, you know, on this note of when we're talking really about the system of international relations currently in place, what do you make of the reactions of China and, to a lesser degree, rising powers such as India to Russia's actions? I mean, we saw they abstained from the Security Council votes, but also China maybe offered less support than it initially seemed to Russia. What do you think is happening there? What are these states thinking?
Well, this is a hard question for me to respond. But it seems to me that for China, it makes no sense to somehow extremely or exorbitantly support Russia. What would be their gain? On the other hand, it makes sense for them to, at least to some extent, support Russia. By the way, for China, the current situation is really not that bad. You know, because Russia will be hit hard, China will become much more important trading partner and in general partner on the international chessboard. And also, if the United States will be more focused in the next few years on Eastern Europe, that's a net gain for China in Southeast China Sea. You know, that's that this part of the world has almost became the focus for the United States over the past decade. Yet it seems possible right now that the Americans will have to, at least to some extent, divert their focus, which is obviously beneficial for China. On the other hand, it makes no sense for China right now to somehow aggressively support Russia, because I think they are not prepared for such a kind of action, which might lead to plenty of unexpected consequences even for them.
Okay, my last question. We've been talking about major powers, Russia, China, America, the West. But what do you think of the response of the Czech Republic and, I guess, of Central Europe as part of the EU to the situation? You might argue that it's a sort of standard response, maybe, of a smaller state in a larger hegemonic group, but if you avoided that answer, or you know, yeah, what I mean?
Definitely. It's possible to see that Czech Republic is trying to help somehow. The same goes for Poland. Obviously, the capabilities of or options of the Czech Republic are different from, for example, Poland. So just for example, we sent arms, we are delivering some humanitarian aid, and it's probably all what we can do now. We actually are probably planning to send some heavier equipment. Obviously, we are limited by the fact that our army was quite depleted in past two decades. So we do not have plenty to give away. On the other hand, Poland has much bigger stockpiles and they were much more serious about preparing for a war, so they can do much more. But I wouldn't say that Czech Republic is doing nothing. Obviously, true is that with the limited options we have, it's not reasonable to expect that the Czech Republic could do much more than this.